It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll explore the world of Milwaukee church festivals and the unique culture that sprung up around them.
First, the Boy Scouts of America is deciding to lift its ban on gay leadership today. The organization reversed its policy banning openly gay scouts 2 years ago.
This change allows troops to hire leaders without regard to sexual orientation, but would also allow troops chartered by religious organizations to continue to hire leaders in accordance with religious beliefs. This comes months after Boy Scouts President Robert Gates called for an end to the ban, and at a time when prosecutors in New York and Colorado are investigating the organization's hiring practices.
Zach Walls is with us now. He's an Eagle Scout and Executive Director of Scouts for Equality. Zach, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, this issue of gay scout leaders has been a hot topic for a long time. Why is the move to allow gay scout leaders happening now?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. When Scouts for Equality was co-founded in June of 2012, the very next month, in July 2012, the Boy Scouts doubled down. They reaffirmed their ban and said it was never going to change. In the 3 years since, we've seen a couple of things happen. First, as you pointed out in the intro, they lifted their ban on gay youth. It doesn't make a lot of sense to tell a gay kid that he can be a member of the Boy Scouts until his 18th birthday and then kick him out. Second, there's also been a big change in the national environment. Over the last 3 years, we've seen a very strong embrace of the LGBT community by the broader American public, and I think that had a big influence on the Boy Scouts' decision. And then finally, as you mentioned, there are some impending legal threats to the Boy Scouts, and they wanted to preempt those before they went to court.
Now, a part of this decision is expected to be that leaders, church organizations in particular, can choose leaders whose beliefs are consistent with their own. Do you see this as being a major sticking point or being seen as a holding back of sorts?
Well, we certainly believe that discrimination at any level sends a harmful message to kids, gay and straight alike, and discrimination has no place in scouting. And at the same time, it's clear to us that this resolution, if it's approved, and I want to stress that it hasn't been finalized by the board yet, that'll be happening later today, if it is approved, this will be leading to less discrimination, and that's an important step forward for the Boy Scouts.
What does this decision mean to you?
I've got two gay moms, Jackie and Terry, and I was lucky enough to live in a progressive town in Iowa City, Iowa, and they were able to be a part of my scouting experience. But if I'd grown up in a smaller town that was potentially more conservative, like Marshfield, Wisconsin, for example, that might not have necessarily been the case, and it might have been more difficult to have them be a part of my scouting experience. And to know that across the country there are going to be Boy Scout troops and Cub Scout packs where gay adults can participate in their son's scouting experience without any fear, that's really good to know.
Do you think that this will satisfy both the people who wanted to be able to, as the Boy Scouts put it, choose leaders whose beliefs are consistent with their own, and also people who would like to see a more liberal Boy Scouts of America? Will it satisfy everybody?
I think it's at any rate a good compromise. Unfortunately, I think it's difficult to get everyone to agree on anything. But I think that what we'll definitely see is folks who left the organization because they opposed the ban. I think a lot of those people are going to come back, and hopefully we won't see too many people walk away because they support the ban.
We're talking right now with Zach Walls. He's an Eagle Scout and Executive Director of Scouts for Equality. We're talking today about the Boy Scouts of America moving to end its ban on gay leaders and volunteers today. And do you think it's fair to characterize the Boy Scouts as a conservative organization, or are the demographics changing?
Historically speaking, I think it's accurate to categorize the Boy Scouts as a conservative institution, absolutely. And I think that was further accelerated, so to speak, by the fact that the Boy Scouts defended their ban on gay members all the way to the Supreme Court and then won that Supreme Court decision. By fighting all the way and defending that ban so stridently, I think that a lot of liberals and moderates who were in the Boy Scouts were shocked by that decision, and a lot of them left. And actually, if you look at the membership of the Boy Scouts, ever since James Dale, who was the assistant scoutmaster who wound up challenging the ban and what would later become the Supreme Court decision, Dale v. BSA, ever since he was removed at the beginning of the 1990s, the BSA has really seen a structural decline year after year. And that has to, in part, be explained by the fact that younger parents, who are the ones who enroll their kids in the Cub Scouts, are increasingly supportive of the LGBT community.
And yet there was a decline of 7% membership after the youth ban was lifted in 2013, meaning that gay youth were allowed in the organization at that time. What do you think about that shift downward at that time when that decision was made?
Well, the year before that, the membership loss was 6%. Like I said, the Boy Scouts are unfortunately trapped in this structural membership loss year after year. And so I certainly am not under any illusions. I suspect that the Boy Scouts will see a higher number than normal of people leave the organization this year, and it's going to take them a long time to repair the damage that they've done in defending this very homophobic policy for so, so long. And so I certainly don't think that this is going to get better overnight. But I do know that Scouts for Equality, if the Boy Scouts make the right decision this evening, our organization is ready to help build new, fully inclusive units. We want to work to bring progressive faith groups back into the scouting family. Hopefully we'll bring some of the public schools that left back into the scouting family. We want to make sure that the Boy Scouts are able to use good anti-bullying programs to protect the kids they do have. And we really want to see a strong, inclusive scouting movement for a long, long time to come.
How do you think court decisions in recent years and a shift in public opinion have affected the organization overall?
Well, I think that those decisions and those changes in public opinion reflect a changing country. And the Boy Scouts is an iconic American institution, and insofar as that's the case, I think it makes sense that it reflects the broader population. This is an organization that's been around for more than a century. It was lionized by Norman Rockwell. It enjoys an official congressional charter from the U.S. Congress and the President of the United States to the honorary President of the Boy Scouts. And so this is really an organization that was, by design, meant to represent the United States of America. And as we see through a shifting legal environment, through shifting public opinion, I think it makes a lot of sense that the Boy Scouts of America is going to reflect that evolving, growing, progressing America. Absolutely.
Now, Robert Gates, the president of the Boy Scouts of America, had earlier made the remark that the Boy Scouts had to deal with the world as it is, not as if one would wish it to be. Do you think that coming on board, Robert Gates has done what the organization needed and what members were hoping for and expecting?
Well, I'd like to put that remark in just a little bit of context. What he said right before he said that statement was, "I'll tell you the same thing that I had to tell presidents when I was the director of CIA and the Secretary of Defense, which is that we have to deal with the world as it is, not as we may wish it to be." I don't think that Robert Gates holds any personal animus to gay people, and I think it's important to understand that context and listening to that remark. And I think that he's certainly demonstrated leadership in addressing the issue. The reality was that when the Boy Scouts ended their ban on gay youth, I think they probably figured that bought them, you know, 4 or 5 years. But when it became clear that they were going to have to deal with this sooner rather than later, Dr. Gates, on May 21st, barely 2 months ago, said, "Look, I think the ban is unsustainable and it has to change." And now, 2 months later, the Boy Scouts are on the verge of actually changing the policy. He took swift, decisive action. And frankly, it's kind of reassuring to know that people who are capable of swift and decisive action were working at the highest levels of our government.
And what do you see as being next for Scouts for Equality, that organization, and also the Boy Scouts of America nationally?
Well, we certainly, as I said, want to see a strong and prosperous Boy Scouts of America. Pending the outcome of tonight's vote, we're interested in working and collaborating with the Boy Scouts to help charter new inclusive units, to develop new anti-bullying programs to protect all of the Boy Scouts members, and to making sure that, you know, there are units in every community across the country where gay youth and gay adults feel welcome, not just tolerated, but actually included. In terms of the Boy Scouts of America, there's going to be a lot of healing of wounds. Obviously, this has been a very contentious issue, and it for a lot of people is very controversial. And so I think what has to happen next is that the Boy Scouts have to show that what is at the core of the Boy Scouts of America, you know, cultivating environmental stewardship and leadership ability and community service, that those things aren't going to change. What's going to change is simply that those core values and those core principles are going to be accessible to even more people than before. And that's something that we should all be celebrating.
Zach, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Zach Walls, Eagle Scout and Executive Director of Scouts for Equality. Summer is festival season in Wisconsin. Since we only have a few months of good weather, we tend to do a pretty good job of making the most of it. We've got music festivals, county fairs, and even the state fair. But on a more local level, there's one tradition alive and well in many Milwaukee neighborhoods, the annual church festival.
For those looking to have a good time in the city, it seems there's a church festival happening just about every weekend through the summer. Through the years, a very uniquely Wisconsin culture has sprung up around those festivals. That's what our next guest set out to explore.
Joining us now is Ron Fayola. He's a Milwaukee-based filmmaker, and his latest documentary, Tilt-A-Whirl's Cowbells and Beer, premieres tonight on Milwaukee Public Television. Ron, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So let's start off by playing a clip from the documentary, and this is one of the festival organizers that you spoke with talking about the uniqueness of this church festival phenomenon. Here it is.
I think being in Milwaukee, because there's a lot of these festivals, people are very much more in tune that there is actually live music and festivals and places to go and just relax and have a good time, where around the country there's not as much of that in any way, shape, or form.
So how did this become such a Milwaukee tradition?
I think it's because of the organization that these churches go through to put on their festivals and get their vendors. It's called CFC, a Council Festival Committee, and they have an annual trade show in January. And all festivals that are members of CFC, including church festivals, get their everything. It's like one-stop shopping for everything from porta potties to tents and bands and beer and so on. And I don't think any other city has this organization or organized like this.
And why are the churches hosting these festivals in the first place? What are they accomplishing with them?
It's basically a fundraiser for the parish, but it's also a way for the parishioners and the local neighborhood to come in and just have a good time. It's free. Prices of food and drink are pretty decent, and you get to see some cool bands or your favorite polka band or whatever it is, you know.
So you've got all these church festivals going on in Milwaukee. What are the common denominators that they have in common?
Some have rides, some don't have the space for that, so they all have bands of some sort and games anywhere from, spot game to games for kids where they get a little prize or you pull the candy out of a thing and you get a prize and all sorts of stuff. And it's really family oriented. You can bring everybody over and in the movie they call it asphalt cuisine. You can have your burgers and brats and so on, and then Friday fish fry and Sunday chicken dinners.
And it seems like from some of the people you talk to, there are some festival fans who really make the rounds and they know the favorite bands and when they're playing at all the festivals. Are there aficionados who try to hit all of these in the summer?
Absolutely, yeah. And there's that really sweet couple that are polkateers, and they're going to turn 80 this year, and they're out there dancing every weekend at church festivals. They say that they go to two or three a weekend when they can.
One thing you kind of get at in your documentary is what you could see as sort of a disconnect between these being church festivals and the amount of drinking that goes on at these festivals. There are even these T-shirts that say "Drinking for Jesus." How do people kind of reconcile all that?
That's the weird part. We never had anybody, when we mentioned the Drinking for Jesus, we didn't have anybody say, "I really hate that," you know. I think it's just part of the thought process of that the money's going to the church. So, I want to have a beer. That's great. The church gets the money. So,
talking to Ron Fayola about his new documentary, Tilt-A-Whirl's Cowbells and Beer. Now, one thing I learned from this is these festivals can be a gamble. As you said, it's partly for community, but it's also a fundraiser. A lot of money goes in up front. And then if you've got bad weather, you've got a problem. So are people up late at night worrying what it's going to turn out like the next day?
Absolutely. And there's stories of festivals that had a storm come through and tear up the tents and knock over heavy machinery and things, and or the place turns into a big muddy field, you know, that kills your profit. And it also, you can buy rain insurance, but there's a, it's really unique, and the way they do it is kind of not worth, you know, doing that because it just doesn't pay. But there's certainly some very, you know, big risks involved.
One part of the culture of these things that we haven't talked about yet is the prominence of the polka. It seems like there's polka bands, people polka dancing, references that go back to the polka mass, which sort of ties in there. Can you talk about the polka?
Yeah, there's even the polka plate at one of the festivals. It was just a sausage. But the polka is big, and the polka masses are unique. And it started in the 70s up in Minnesota. And people like going to those. It livens up the service a little bit. And then after they're done, they go out and have chicken dinner on. And, you know, and they'll dance, you know, the polka band will go out and play too. And that's when, you know, and people just, that's a common denominator for music wise, at least during the afternoon and especially like on Sundays.
And you followed one church's festival. It was going to be its last festival. I believe it was the St. Veronica Parish. There are challenges facing these festivals. Others have been on and off over the years. What are some of the challenges facing them these days with keeping it going?
The two major challenges, especially for St. Veronica's, was getting volunteers, number one. And the other one was the insurance and safety codes that they lost a tent because of this new safety regulation. So they, instead of having two band tents, they only have one. They have a lot less space. But the volunteer thing is the hardest part, and nobody wants to volunteer. You know, you get people that'll say, "Yeah, I'll do the bartending, sure," but you don't. You know, people don't want to pick up garbage or stay up late at night doing the cleanup and stuff. So that's a major point there.
Well, would you consider these church festivals endangered, or are they doing okay in Milwaukee?
They're doing okay, certainly. We've lost many of them since, you know, in the last 25 years. There's a lot more stricter drunk driving laws, and people don't spend as much as they used to, but people will still keep going, and even if the festivals downsize a little bit, people will always keep going to a church festival.
Now, you mentioned that conference where people go for that one-stop shopping. I had to say, if I needed a Tilt-A-Whirl, I wouldn't know where to book one, or Port-A-John's, or family-friendly musical performances. This is quite an event. What all can the visitors find there?
It's great. There's, you know, just like any sort of convention, there's booths with the porta potty guys and the rides, the midways, there's even like wine and beer guys, and they give you samples, and sausage companies, and you, hey, try this and try that, and so it's a lot of fun, and it's in the winter. It's not on a weekend when the Packers are playing, so they get a big turnout, and that's the key there is they can make their deals and they're done. They don't have to spend 6 months, you know, calling individually all these places and getting bids from everybody. They can pretty much make their deals that day.
So they may get a lot of the shopping done at this one-stop shop you talk about, but it seems like a lot of the food, at least the fish fry, is made by hand, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of food is made by the volunteers. They rely on their parishioners to come in and help with the fish fry. The Knights of Columbus come in at certain church festivals to do the fish fry. There's also a church, St. Florian's, that has a really good fish fry, and they go around to other festivals themselves and make the fish fry for them. So it's very friendly that way.
And we haven't gotten into the music, another big part of this. One of the band guys, I think, said, hey, we're here to play covers that people want to hear. We're not playing original stuff. There are some bands that are rock stars of the festival scene.
Absolutely, yeah. You have Rhythm Method, which is an interesting name for a church festival band. But, you know, and they're hugely popular, and they have an offshoot band called Light Up, which does all Styx covers. And but these people, when they're hiring the bands, they're looking for the band that's going to sell the most beer. So, I mean, they, you know, obviously they want a good act, but they're not saying, boy, I really like, you know, this guy who plays the banjo over here. They're looking for the band that's going to draw the most people in and, you know, serve a lot of beer.
Well, it's a lot of fun. Ron, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was filmmaker Ron Faola. His new documentary looks at church festivals in Milwaukee. It's called Tilt-A-Whirls, Cowbells, and Beer. It premieres tonight on Wisconsin Public Television.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. In some communities around the state, young first-time offenders appear before a teen court where teenagers decide the consequences for their peers. Now young people in Wisconsin's largest city are trying to establish their own teen court.
The Milwaukee Youth Council, a 14-member group with representatives from around the city, are working on a proposal to implement a teen court. They say the court would help cut down on recidivism and would be good for the younger population in Milwaukee.
We have two members of the Milwaukee Youth Council with us today, Kaylin Haywood II, who is the executive member, and Abena May. We also have Marilyn Young with us. She's the coordinator of the Menominee Falls Teen Court, which has been up and running for almost 20 years. All three of the guests are joining from our downtown Milwaukee studios. Kaylin, Abena, welcome to Central Time.
Hi.
How are you?
Good,
Hi.
Thanks. And Marilyn, welcome.
Thank you.
Kaylin, we start with you now. Can you tell us a little bit how a teen court works? What happens?
Well, when the idea originally started, the idea was that when teens and youth go to the municipal court, the judge would actually refer them to the teen court to go through the teen court process. But after talking to the judges from the municipal court, which we thanked for meeting with us, we determined that it would be better if the teen court, youth court, happened before. So the idea is now we're trying to partner with MPD to see if it would be possible to put the youth court date on the ticket, so it gives the youth the option to come to the youth court. So when they come to the youth court, they will sit among the jury of their peers, and we hear their story. And the goal of that is to actually have people who are your age that can relate to you, and we give them an alternative instead of them being put in the system. They get an alternative. They get a certain amount of time to complete that test, and hopefully when they do, they come back to us, and we can release the ticket from ever getting to the municipal court.
And Abena, tell us about what that task might be. This is the consequence for the action that we're talking about. What do you imagine being an example of that kind of thing?
We went through a lot of different ideas as far as what the consequences would be for a said youth who will go through the teen court. Many of them, well, mainly one of them is more so seeing it from an educational standpoint and putting them through classes in which they can reprimand their wrongdoing, such as if it was something as small as petty theft, they would then attend a class in which would teach them why petty theft is wrong and other ways they can receive the thing that they were stealing for, because it could have been for obvious reasons or other reasons, like things like I needed food, I needed help, and no one would help me, you know, things like that. And just going at it from an educational standpoint, that really would, we feel, be more of a consequence, but a way of teaching and teaching them not to do the same thing again.
Yeah, I like to refer to it not as a consequence, but as an alternative.
As an alternative. So you're not thinking about this at all as punishment, say, for example.
Correct. It's more so of a way for teens to feel like they're not being, reprimanded, like a consequence for something small as a misdemeanor, and actually just showing them that, hey, this could have been done a different way.
And Kaylin, you mentioned staying out of the system. Why is that important?
Because usually when someone starts in the system, it becomes a revolving door, and it just keeps repeating itself. And when people see that you're in the system, they start to judge you off of that. When you apply for a job, you get a background check. It pops up on your name. So just trying to give you a chance to not have that record and to stop people from judging you from your background record that may or may not be completely accurate, but actually get to know you first.
And Marilyn, let's bring you in on this. You are with the Menominee Falls Teen Court. Now, this has been established in Menominee Falls for about 20 years. How does the teen court in Menominee Falls work?
Well, when a defendant comes to teen court, he or she and their parents meet with a defense attorney for about half an hour before their case is heard in a private room. And then they are brought into the courtroom where there are teen jurors and a bailiff, a clerk, and they are asked to testify. Their defense attorney defends them. Prosecuting attorneys ask questions of them. After the defendant testifies, then their parent is asked to testify also. Jurors are given the opportunity to ask questions of the kids, and then once all testimony is finished and questions have been answered, the jurors go into deliberation and decide on a sentence, and then come back out into the courtroom and announce their sentence. And then the parent and the defendant, once that case has been adjourned, meet with me out in the hall while a next case is called, so that we can go over everything that happened, sentencing guidelines, deadlines, that type of thing.
Now, you just used a lot of legal terms there, like defendant and jury and defense. So how formal is this? Is this something that is a bit of a big deal, actually? Or do you see it as something that's a more informal alternative?
No, I think I would consider it a formal proceeding. If you went to court under any other circumstances, if it were a jury trial, you would be judged by your peers, as our juries do, and our defendants have to admit guilt in order to come to teen court in the first place. So that isn't something that's judged by the jury. They simply are there to hear what happened and to deliberate, to decide what a proper sentence would be.
So is this a conversation that's happening between the person you're calling the defendant and the members of the jury, or is this something that's more, again, more formalized, like a trial?
No, the questions that our defense attorneys and prosecuting attorneys ask are very, very much more informal than certainly you would see at an adult trial. They ask what happened and why a defendant did what they did, and if they're remorseful, they ask about what kinds of consequences or punishments the children might have received at home or at school, if it was a school incident or what have you, because that helps the jury determine what would be a fair sentence for the defendant.
We're talking right now about a proposal to implement a teen court in Milwaukee. We have two members of the Milwaukee Youth Council with us today, Caitlin Haywood II, the executive member, and Abena May. And we're also speaking with Marilyn Young. She's the coordinator of the Menominee Falls Teen Court, which has been up and running for about 20 years. And let's go back to you, Caitlin, now. Now, we have a quote here, a comment from one of our listeners on Facebook. He says, "Adolescents' lack of empathy is one of their defining factors, so I would definitely expect harsher sentences, especially from the kind of person interested in this sort of thing." Do you see that as a concern, something that you're looking at as you go into this, Caitlin?
No, I actually wouldn't. I wouldn't think that someone that is your peer who can relate to you, who can possibly put themselves in the same shoes, would give you a serious alternative. I mean, we're not just targeting those outstanding people of society that people think are the utmost best. We're trying to get everyone in the city, so those people who can relate, those people who have been in those situations. So not only is it going to be those people who haven't done anything, who have been sheltered all their life, it's going to be people from the actual community and people who actually have been in the same situation.
Marilyn, you've been watching this for 20 years. As you see it play out, are the peers, do you think, pretty tough, or what do you see as a dynamic?
I think that people may be amazed at how incredibly perceptive teens are. As I said, coming into teen court in Menominee Falls, you admit guilt or we can't accept you as a defendant. So there isn't going to be a great deal of empathy if you've already admitted to what you did. However, we're going to be able to tell, and teens are really, really good about this, whether you were genuinely sorry for what you did or whether you're just sorry you got caught. And whether you feel that you've been unjustly cited or what have you, you can't be there unless you admitted to it. So I think based on what the defendants say and how they say it, again, what kind of consequences they've had at home, and very often the teens are, as jurors, are very, very sympathetic to the parents. In listening to the parents testify, I think it brings it home to not only those defendants, but also to the teens in the courtroom, how parents are affected when a child is cited and how frightened and embarrassed and angry they sometimes are when they get that phone call from the police saying, we have your child and you need to come and pick him or her up.
And the youth court judges aren't there to judge you. They're actually there to help you.
Right, correct.
Abena, why do you think peers would be effective at deciding consequences for someone?
Well, just going off the youth court standpoint, just like sitting back as the president, I noticed that there are different things that people just see about us from the jump, like just from being youth, that we are teens of like who can't decide for ourselves, that we actually need an adult there 24/7 to make our decisions. And I don't see that happening. With the teen court, it allows I believe that the people that are chosen, that are picked, and who will enforce this will actually take it from a standpoint as to not even just so much judging them, but seeing them as their peers and saying, hey, we need to help them get back on the right track. Because like Kaylin said before, once they get into the system, it's a revolving door. It's kind of really hard to get your name back to its original state and your reputation to get back to its original state. So I do believe that the teen court can stand its own ground.
We're talking about a proposal for a teen court in Milwaukee now. Joining us, Kaylin Haywood II and Abena May from the Milwaukee Youth Council. Also, Marilyn Young of the Menominee Falls Teen Court is also with us.
We're taking your calls, too. What do you think about this idea of a teen court? Do you have one in your community? Have you participated one on any end of the equation? How has it affected youth in your community? Maybe the crime rate? Do you think it could help Milwaukee and other cities? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion now with Kaylin Haywood II and Abena May of the Milwaukee Youth Council. We're also talking with Marilyn Young, coordinator for the Menominee Falls Teen Court. We're talking about the Milwaukee Youth Council's plan to implement one of these courts in Milwaukee.
We're taking your calls. What do you think about the idea of a teen court in Milwaukee in your community? Do you think they're a good idea in general? Do you have one in your community, and have you ever participated in one? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We go to our callers now. We have Elise joining us from Milwaukee. Hi there.
Hi. I think this is a wonderful idea to have a teen court. I think the biggest reason why is it can help those that are assigned to teen court cognitively think through their actions and get reflections from their chronological peers. People who understand where they are coming from in today's world, in their terms, I just think it's a fabulous idea.
Thank you for that call, Elise. Appreciate that. And Marilyn, do you see it playing out that way, that there is maybe more reflection involved in this process?
Yes, I think that's entirely true.
Can you tell us a little bit about the recidivism angle? We haven't touched on that yet, and I know that is a main goal of these teen courts, stopping a repeat sort of action from these young people involved. Has it worked that way in Menominee Falls?
It has. It's very rare for a defendant to reoffend. However, once they get that second citation, we can't help. We only take defendants on their first citation. Once they've completed their sentence and met all their deadlines, then that citation is dismissed as if it never happened. If they get a second citation, then they'll be going to municipal court, and it will remain on their record.
Do you see that these young people coming into this teen court process, Marilyn, are taking it seriously, being sincere in their efforts?
Yes, certainly all of our volunteers are very serious, and I'm amazed, Veronica, at the level of activity of young people today. They're so busy with school and sports and other extracurricular activities and church and many, many things going on, and yet the volunteers are very, very dedicated to the process. Most of the teens that we see as defendants are genuinely remorseful. They feel badly for what they did. They feel like they know better and won't reoffend. And every once in a while, we get someone who's there with an attitude, and it's not hard for the jury to pick up on that. And it's also not unusual for them to perhaps be a little bit more harsh with their sentence because they feel that that person doesn't feel badly for what they did only because they got caught. Mm-hmm.
Now, Abana, I want to talk about redirection, because once you've got this person involved in the teen court and they've gotten their alternative or their consequence, is there an effort after that to keep on redirecting that person to a more positive path?
We have spoken in the past a couple meetings after we started to look more into the teen court. We did speak of mentoring. Getting those people who are outstanding in the community and standing with them through their whole sentencing, and also being there after their sentencing to make sure that they do stay on this on a straight and narrow and don't return to the, I'm going to use this word vaguely, in mistakes that they actually went through and actually did. So yes.
Kaylin, let's talk about the money a little bit here, because the budget for the state of Wisconsin is a little tight. How much would this Milwaukee teen court cost?
That's a good question. I don't believe that the funding for this youth court would come out of the state of Wisconsin's budget, because it is a city of Milwaukee youth court. So I believe it would come out of the city of Milwaukee budget. We're not totally sure about how much it would cost annually, but we're still planning the logistics out, so we wouldn't actually know until we finalize everything and we actually got all the details laid out in order to find out how much that would actually cost.
Now, Abana and Kaylin, the both of you are, I think, teenagers, correct?
Yes.
So how do you find time in your own life? You've got schoolwork and then this teen court, which sounds like it's very consuming. You're having these long conversations with the people who come and sit in front of you to be given their alternatives and to learn from this. So how do you plan to find time for this in your own lives? Kaylin, let's go with you first.
Well, the thing is, the City of Milwaukee Youth Council and the City of Milwaukee Youth Corps would be two separate entities. The Youth Council will still have its members and we will still do our thing, but the Youth Corps will actually give other youth in the city a chance to do public service. So there may be some members interested from the Youth Council to participate in Youth Corps, but it won't strictly be Youth Council members being the Youth Corps as well. So we're going to extend that opportunity out to other youth in the city in order to get them involved in public service. So that's up to them how they balance that out.
Okay, and Abana?
Same response. It's really more so, it's really dependent upon who wants to be involved. If going on the standpoint, if I personally was a part of the teen court, I am personally really involved in my youth involvement. I do believe that no matter how we are projected and seen, we are still good youth. We all deserve a chance. So I personally would just make time. I have 24 hours in a day. So, it just has to be a drive there, period. No matter what you do, no matter what, if you're in a teen court or youth court, it has to be a drive and it has to be a want to make a difference.
So how motivated are you and optimistic that this is something that can happen in the near future?
Oh, I'm very optimistic. I know if this happens, there's going to be a change. I know that we're going to start as youth and teen in Milwaukee, and just starting in Milwaukee, starting at our own home, our home front, just making each other accountable and making each other know, like, hey, what you've done is was not okay, but I'm here to pick you up and help you, can really change someone, can really make a stance and bring a lot of unity in the city of Milwaukee, period.
And Kalen, what are the next steps with this to get this off the ground?
Well, currently, our most recent thing, we met with the municipal court judges. We talked with them. We came up with our most recent idea for the youth court. So now we're waiting on the LRB to type up some details and resolutions and to get all the logistics together. And then the youth council itself is going to sit down, look at it, try to finalize it, tweak it, make it what it needs to be. And we're going to look for those partners in the city and the community to actually help us out. We're going to need those community partners, schools, law enforcement, and people like that. So, yeah, finding partners and finalizing the details is our next step.
And have you guys heard from your peers, your friends, and Buzz at school that, yeah, we want this in Milwaukee?
Yes, we've actually told each other in multiple meetings, let this be known, talk to people, see what they want in the community, how would they view this, and just sitting down, and people that really care about us will ask us, what's going on with the youth council? We'll bring up the teen court, and they'll tell us, hey, that's a good idea. That would be a lot better than being so intimidated with going up upon an adult jury and an adult judge, because that can be very scary.
I personally haven't heard a lot from youth in the city about it. A lot of them aren't aware of it, so I'm glad we have the opportunity to come on the radio station and actually talk about it to get them aware, get them involved, and start hearing what they have to say.
Well, thank you all so much for joining me. I appreciate it.
No problem.
You're welcome. We've been speaking with Kalen Haywood II, executive member of the Milwaukee Youth Council, Abena May, president of the Milwaukee Youth Council, and Marilyn Young, coordinator of the Menominee Falls Teen Court. They were all joining us to talk about the Youth Council's proposal to implement a teen court in Milwaukee.
Today is the anniversary of the birthday of a legendary Wisconsinite. On this day in 1938, Gary Gygax was born in Chicago, soon moved with his family to Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. He became known as the co-creator of the staggeringly popular and influential role-playing game Dungeons & Dragons.
Now, some of his fans have declared today an unofficial holiday, and they want to celebrate Gary Gygax Day by inviting people to play Dungeons & Dragons, or one of the other role-playing games that it inspired.
Gygax passed away in 2008. Here he was in 2000 in an episode of the animated science fiction comedy Futurama as himself, with Al Gore, Stephen Hawking, and Star Trek's Nichelle Nichols.
Anyone want to play Dungeons & Dragons for the next quadrillion years?
Sure, I guess. Pawn to
Rook 8. I'm a 10th level vice president.
Gary Gygax there. So an influential person in my life, certainly. I discovered the game at an early age, played it a fair amount.
That explains your high wisdom score.
I think I'm pretty weak on wisdom in this life. Yeah, and charisma, though. I've got it. No, maybe not that either. Okay. Well, anyway, I think one of our producers is celebrating tonight accidentally by playing D&D. Can I name her? No, that was... I will not out the D&D playing producer.
I think you pretty much did already, but that's okay.
Our one female... Whoops, we only have one female regular producer. Well, there you go. Well, let us know if you're celebrating Gary Gygax Day, the informal holiday. Send us a message on Facebook, Central Time on WPR, or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.